You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
Türkiye'de.
The decision has been made to declare a state of emergency for a period of 3 months in Turkey.
President Recep Tayyip Erdogan formalises his post-coup crackdown, but how long will his state of emergency really last, and how far will it really go? My guests Michael Goldfarb and George Brock will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including...
If you have the proof and you catch somebody, I definitely feel that you should take action. The open violation in track and field is getting really bad, so do you feel like you need to make a statement, then thumbs up.
Usain Bolt there, reflecting on why Russian athletes look more and more likely to be watching the Rio Olympics on television. And Ted Cruz gets poor reviews from the Republican National Convention, but was he set up to fail, and did he succeed anyway? All that, plus we'll discuss the man who inadvertently bequeathed us the phrase to jump the shark, Gary Marshall, who died yesterday. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are George Brock, Professor of Journalism at City University London, also a former journalist for The Observer and The Times, and Michael Goldfarb, veteran journalist and broadcaster. Welcome both to the show. We will start tonight with a tale of two states of emergency, one instituted in Turkey following last week's abortive coup d'etat, the other extended in France following last week's terrorist attack in Nice. Turkey's was accompanied by a vow from President Recep Tayyip Erdogan that all the viruses within the armed forces will be cleansed, which seems unlikely to end well, whereas in France, Prime Minister Manuel Valls made the weirdly resigned observation that we must learn to live with this menace. Before we discuss both of these, here is a bit more of what President Erdogan had to say.
Türkiye'de.
The decision has been made to declare a state of emergency for a period of 3 months in Turkey. The objective of putting in place this state of emergency is to swiftly and effectively remove the threat to democracy in our country, to the rights of the state, and also the rights and freedoms of citizens. The measure in no way compromises democracy, rights, and freedoms. On the contrary, it is to protect and strengthen these values.
George, first of all, the very real risk of undermining our premise here, are these two situations at all comparable?
No, I don't think they are, really. If you start with Turkey, the one thing you can say for sure is that that state of emergency is not going to last only for 3 months. I would imagine that it might very well last for 3 years. And when you said that the French Prime Minister Manuel Valls was sounding a bit weary, saying that people have got to get used to living with terrorism, I think I would congratulate him for being much more realistic than politicians usually are when talking in the context of a state of emergency. He knows perfectly well that measures against terrorism that actually work are intelligence measures that nobody can know about and take a very long time to work, and therefore it is quite likely there may, alas, be other terrorist attacks before the French security authorities start to succeed better.
Michael, just continuing with the French one in particular, what do you think? Was that the Prime Minister being, as I said, weirdly defeatist, or does he deserve a round of applause for acknowledging the likelihood that there will be more where that came from?
Well, I sort of agree with George. I mean, I think he's entitled to some kudos for speaking the truth. We often ask for the truth from our politicians, and then when they speak it, vote them out of office. And, I mean, maybe he's being fatalistic since his party is likely to lose the presidency next year anyway.
But is he not, though, sorry to interrupt, throwing a massive bone to populists like the Front National by saying we must learn to live with this menace? That does rather prompt the obvious response from a populist like Marine Le Pen saying, well, no, we don't.
Well, yes.
I mean, obviously, drastic and terrible things we could do to...
Of course, that's true. And I suppose we'll see how that plays out. I have not been in France in some time, so I can't say for sure whether enough people understand that the possibilities of policing someone who seems to be slightly on the edge anyway and then self-radicalizes and goes off and, you know, drives at high speed through a crowd is something that can be stopped. and the French clearly don't have the same, haven't put the same resources into penetrating their Muslim communities that one assumes the British have, because we have blessedly, you know, not had a major event here for 11 years, which isn't to say that there aren't plenty of, that plenty is the wrong word, I take that back, that there aren't those who would be contemplating it in this country. But as George rightly pointed out, the best way to police these things is very quietly, and nobody actually knows what's going on. And, you know, beyond that, I wonder if there's enough in public opinion in France that people actually understand that at a, at an instinctive level, even if they'd like to know that the state is perfectly capable of rounding up miscreants about 10 minutes before they get self-radicalized.
George, you were pointing out there that it seems unlikely that Turkey's state of emergency will last just the 3 months. France's has been extended for another 6 months. Do you have any, is it possible, I guess, to have any idea of what the circumstances might look like at which France will scale it back or call it off or return things to normal?
Well, I think probably the answer is the absence of attacks, because a state of emergency is partly a matter of operational measures for policemen, but it's also partly a reassurance to the public. Can I just remind you that the state of emergency in France equips the government with quite a lot less powers than the Turkish leader has taken.
Indeed.
If you go into a shop and ask for the basic dictator's toolkit, you get a toolkit which says you can bypass parliament, you don't have to take any notice of the constitutional court, you can have new powers to arrest people, and you can have restrictions on speech and assembly. That's exactly what Erdogan has taken. That is not what we're talking about in the French case.
Yeah. The interesting thing, of course, is that he would say that, well, in fact, any laws that I pass or enact, he doesn't have to pass them, in this period of state of emergency, can then subsequently be revoked by Parliament. But unfortunately, he's created a rubber stamp Parliament for himself by manipulating the democratic process last year and having a second vote when he had lost the opportunity to create a powerful presidency. Basically, they had another vote, and now he can create this powerful presidency. I mean, the other thing to consider in talking about Turkey and why one should be really, really worried about the state of civil society when this is all over is, I'm not sure if there's a real state, if a state of emergency has been declared in Kurdistan, but over the last year and a half, I mean, he's essentially been at war with his Kurdish population in southeastern Turkey and devastated that part of the country, a country that I know well and that I have visited under previous, I don't know if it's states of emergency or just martial rule. And he's gone well beyond that in terms of physical destruction of the Kurdish parts of the country. So whatever he says in terms of, well, this I'm suspending the European, what does the C stand for there? In
Convention.
HR. Convention on human rights. Thank you, George. George is an editor. I'm just a reporter. He fills in my blanks. You know, that he's suspending the ECHR, which, you know, if this is something that puts even further onto a back burner the prospect of Turkey ever advancing in its attempts to join the European Union. And we'll see. I mean, I have, frankly, no great hope that this 3 month state of emergency will end in 3 months, or that if it does, the measures passed will then somehow be off the statute books. I think he'll power grab. And besides which, he's already got how many? 15,000 teachers have already been sacked. I mean,
the number of people who have been sacked, dismissed, suspended, arrested, or otherwise purged now exceeds 50,000.
And it's not even a full week since this coup.
Indeed not. We will have ample opportunity, I suspect, to return to that one. We will move along now. 2 weeks tomorrow, the flame will be lit inaugurating the Rio Olympic Games. It does appear increasingly that whatever time the House Orchestra has spent rehearsing the Russian national anthem may have been wasted. The Court of Arbitration for Sports has upheld the ban placed on Russia by the IAAF after revelations of widespread doping in Russian athletics. A few Russian athletes may be permitted, they say, to compete as neutrals if they can persuade pertinent authorities that they have not been tainted by the doping program. George, as I understand it, the final opportunity for Russia to be allowed to compete is by appealing to the better nature of the IOC, which is going to make a decision this weekend. Should the IOC try to find some way to allow Russia to compete in some shape or form?
No, I don't think it should. For me, the difference seems to be that is the involvement of the state. I mean, what came out the other day, I mean, it's been a long story, there have been many episodes, but the latest episode was absolutely hard evidence of the involvement of the state in concealing the doping, in making sure that it wasn't found out on the scale that it was going on. That, it seems to me, you can only reply to with a ban, which may indeed involve some unfairness to individuals. But if you want the government to understand you're serious, I can't see what else you can do.
Michael, what do you think? Because the IOC, obviously, if it bans Russia, that is inviting an absolutely almighty row, and bureaucracies like the IOC are institutionally programmed to want to avoid almighty rows. If they allow Russia to compete, though, any medal a Russian athlete wins is going to have an asterisk next to it, isn't it?
It is. And the interesting thing is, you know, we have spoken across a range of topics about a resurgent Russia under Vladimir Putin, but on this particular one, I mean, if this had happened 25 years ago when there was still a Soviet empire, and they had, I'm sure they probably did have
it's
evidence.
It happened.
They probably had evidence then too. I mean, the Russians would have said, okay, well, then there'll be no Olympics because we'll simply tell these, you know, all of our satellite states, East Germany and Poland and the Baltic states. No, in fact, there'll be no Olympics because if they block Russia, then all of our allies will stay away. That won't happen this time. So if the International Olympic Committee is serious about taking a stand against doping, a real stand, and let's remember that this isn't just about performance enhancement or it's like the Tour de France where everybody does it. You know, remember when Lance Armstrong finally got admitted, all right, I doped. All of his competitors said, well, who are you going to give his titles to? The guy who finished in 20th place? Because we were all doping. This, on the other hand, is something different. And the point is that the dope they use causes cancer. It destroys lives. And the idea that you then have to have everybody competing under when they're doped, I mean, that an American who wants a gold medal or Mo Farah wants he's got a blood dope or whatever, I just think now is the one moment when they could actually make a stand because Russia is just Russia now and not also East Germany and former Yugoslavia and whatever else.
Also, I don't think that it's necessarily a disaster if Russia isn't there. Actually, the Soviet Union wasn't there in 1984 in the LA Games in reply to a boycott that had taken place 4 years before. The Olympic movement survived. It's still there.
A question which I guess is a whimsical hypothetical question which I'll put to you, George. Do you think there's any chance that Russia will just hold its hand up, accept that it's done completely the wrong thing, sit these Olympic Games out with good grace and adjust its behaviour in future?
No.
Michael, are you any more optimistic on that front?
I'm sort of with George on this. I mean, I suppose we'll see. I mean, in your initial question, I fear is the next phase because I don't trust any athletic body based in Geneva or anywhere in Switzerland to actually do the right thing. They are too prone to compromise and also to counting the money out the back door. And I'll wait to see what the IOC does.
I mean, on that subject, though, Russia, George, is due to host the World Cup 2 years from now. Is that seeming an increasingly preposterous prospect to you?
Well, given the spinelessness of sporting authorities, no. But let's not forget, this is a state. What we have now is clear evidence of a state-sponsored conspiracy to conceal cheating. And at the very least, if you were football, you would want Russia to assure you that they weren't going to do that kind of thing in the future.
Well,
whether or not you believe them, that's another thing.
On the basis of the European Championships we've just seen, there doesn't appear to be an issue with performance-enhancing drugs for their football team, or at least not very good ones.
That's perhaps the one consoling item here.
Michael, Russia is already, you can see how they're going to spin this at home. The foreign ministry has called it a crime against sport. This will fit into that narrative of the big bad world ganging up on poor little Russia. I've never quite understood how they overcome the cognitive dissonance needed to absorb the idea that Russia is this tiny, defenseless little state which can, whose very existence is threatened. What are the possible political consequences of that? Because this is quite a big deal to a people who are patriotic, who are very proud, and who have always expressed that through sport. It would be a huge deal for the Olympics, not for them to boycott the Olympics, as they did in 84, but to be told you can't come.
It would be huge, but again, it's in your question, I think. And the idea is that it's win-win for Putin, because he can then say, look at how they treat us, and share the pain of his compatriots at the bigotry shown to Russia, which is, of course, one of the cultural giants of civilization, as we all know, you know, from Pushkin through Tchaikovsky and on and on and on. So I think they'll be all right. Plus, let's remember, the absence of anything like a free and critical press at this moment in Russia means that there won't be voices saying, this is, we've told you, we don't need to cheat. We can do it on our own. Any criticism won't be there. And I'm sure Putin will skate it, and people will be able to indulge, which is something that I think Russians really do enjoy, or Russian society enjoys doing, not individuals. But the society as a whole does like feeling it's under attack and has to, you know, push back hard.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with George Brock and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up next, the Republican National Convention lends new meaning to the phrase booze cruise.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or that smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 via our free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back enjoying cultural nourishment in the form of the Monocle Arts Review, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones, and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are George Brock and Michael Goldfarb. Now, in Cleveland, the Republican National Convention continues to go about as well as might have been expected, which is to say that last night we reached the point at which Ted Cruz emerged as a sentinel of relative decency and common sense. The Texas senator's speech was not remarkable for what it did say, which was the standard soppy boilerplate vis-a-vis freedom and so forth, but did attract considerable hostile attention for what it didn't. To the voluble displeasure of the braying yahoos in big hats on the convention center floor, he declined to endorse his party's nominee for president. Michael, Ted Cruz, is he acting from conscience or expediency here?
He's acting from expedience, without doubt. The convention, there aren't that many people watching, although I imagine this one will have some decent ratings. He's setting himself up for 2020, the idea being that there's no way Donald Trump is going to win this. And, you know, he was offered a slot to speak. He apparently, the reports say, he submitted the speech to be vetted by Trump's people. They knew exactly that he was not going to endorse Donald Trump. And he's setting himself up, in his own mind, for a run at the presidency in 2020. It remains to be seen if a week is a long time in politics. That's 52 weeks times four. That's 208.
208. There'll be a leap year in there somewhere as well.
As well. So look, let's forget it. I mean, I don't see him coming back from this. But, you know, he had his moment, and it provided, what can I say, a bit of drama in what is basically a car crash of a convention so far. But then it is who the man is, who's going to be the nominee.
George, on that point that Michael makes, it does appear that the speech was vetted by the Trump camp, who knew full well that Cruz was going to go up there and not endorse Trump. There's some suggestion that being the case, they had people out prompting the booing. So did the Trump camp think this would work for them?
I think when you're trying to work out what works for Trump,
you have to suspend
normal criteria. The guy is, in a sense, indestructible Teflon politically. You can throw all kinds of disasters at him. Embarrassments can occur, glitches. He just glides on. So there's a very long and honourable tradition, of course, in political conventions of packing the hall with people who heckle your opponents and so on, and paying them on the quiet, and all that's been going on for centuries. They might easily have been doing that. They might have thought that Cruz would make such a fool of himself that actually they would emerge better at the end. But on the whole, the Trump people are not particularly brilliant calculators of that sort. But like I say, they don't need to be, because that candidate just seems to fly above it. Don't ask me why, but he does.
It is extraordinary. I mean, Michael, obviously Ted Cruz is not the only Republican grandee to have refused to endorse Donald Trump. Neither President Bush is at all interested. Romney hasn't turned up. I think even John Kasich, who's the governor of Ohio, isn't coming to the convention.
Yeah, Kasich apparently turned down an approach to be the VP.
All of which is fairly extraordinary. Is it possible, and this may be wishful thinking on my part, that once we are out the other end of the convention, we will see, I guess, more open civil war among the Republicans as senior Republicans, people who do have a genuine sense of civic responsibility, start saying, you have to put country before party. This man in no way should be allowed anywhere near the White House.
I think the Republicans are a lot like the conservatives, I mean, at the grandee level. And whenever some enormous crack appears, like when Michael Gove knifes Boris Johnson in the front the day after the Brexit vote, and it looks like the whole party is falling apart, they've pulled together very smartly. And I think that they want to win. The Republicans, like the conservatives, are about gaining power. But the grandees are comfortable, and they can take the long view, and they can say, we will lose this cycle, and we need to regroup and perhaps rewrite the rules. The thing that will give them hope, I think, is what George was referring to earlier. I mean, the thing about Donald Trump is his organization is essentially his children and him and his current wife. I don't know if the other wives are invited into the family confabs. They can barely organize their real estate businesses. That's why they're constantly having to declare bankruptcy. I don't think they can organize a political party. The question is, how much of the fallout from this is going to taint the Republican Party into the future? And that I don't think anybody knows. And of course, we're making a big assumption here, which is that Trump will actually lose. The polls still indicate that, but it will be closer than it should be. And this is clearly 2016 is a year when anything can happen.
Well, indeed. So, I mean, George, the stakes here are obviously quite high, to understate matters wildly. And that was reinforced by the release of the transcripts of Donald Trump's interview with New York Times, extemporizing on his foreign policy views, specifically his somewhat equivocal attitude to Article 5 of the NATO treaty. I mean, how potentially dangerous is that? Him saying that, well, I'm frankly not sure whether I'd bother to defend the Baltic states.
I think it's very, very dangerous and very disturbing. It's far more important than anything that has gone on in the convention, that interview, actually. If I was living in the Baltic Republics, I'd be strongly tempted to leave right now. We know that, Russia wants to use it as the test ground. There's ample evidence they've been overflying. They've abducted an Estonian security officer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in the past few years. And here is a serious candidate for the American presidency, and NATO is an alliance. Theoretically, all its members are equal, but America is pretty important to it. It's the largest military power in NATO.
It is more equal than others.
Exactly. And there is a serious candidate for the American presidency saying, well, actually, this isn't a complete guarantee. It's conditional. And if I don't think they're stumping out fast enough or enough, then maybe we won't go and defend them. That's pretty dangerous for Europe as a whole, I would say.
The trouble is, of course, with that, Michael, is the conventional political wisdom that foreign policy doesn't shift votes one way or the other in a general election. I mean, is there anybody who was considering voting for Donald Trump who has read that and thought, oh, I don't know?
Well, I mean, first of all, who has read that? And the odds are no, because they don't read the New York Times. But also, It's curious. I mean, if it's framed as they need to pay up, there is a strong, strong strain amongst the Republican Party and certainly amongst people who might consider voting for Trump that, in fact, they should pay up. And that's what they'll hear. They won't consider the global security questions.
Okay. Well, finally tonight.
Shark. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Stupid, yes. Also dumb, but it's something I gotta do.
Fonz, you're not jumping over garbage cans on a bike. You're jumping over a shark.
Now, there is a reason why we are plumbing the depths of the Happy Days archive. It's because the worlds of television and film have this week been mourning the passing of Garry Marshall, creator of Happy Days, among many others. He also bequeaths, however, a much-loved modern colloquialism, thanks to that past peak episode of Happy Days in which Fonzie waterskis implausibly over an undersea predator. The phrase jumping the shark has entered the language for any once imperial force which has begun the process of decline and fall. Gentlemen, is it a phrase that either of you use commonly?
I can honestly say that I don't. It took the death of Garry Marshall to tell me exactly what it was that jumping the shark actually means. And in the course of checking what it did mean and where it came from, I came across actually a better one. The equivalent phrase, also I think mostly in the use in the States, is nuking the fridge.
This one is new to me. Where does nuking the fridge come from?
I'll explain it to you briefly. In the fourth Indiana Jones film, a nuclear weapon is detonated somewhere in the region of Indiana Jones. He avoids getting blown up by shutting himself in a fridge.
Amazing.
A large number of, perhaps a little over-serious scientists pointed out that this was about as implausible as anything that had ever happened in a movie. Hence the phrase, nuking the fridge.
I mean, Michael, are you able to think of things or entities or people that could be said to have jumped the shark?
No, not off the top of my head. I mean, the world is full of shark jumping. Come on. In fact, I didn't even realize that. I think that this shows how much what happens is the episode happened. Now, I was already in my 20s and I wasn't paying much attention. But it didn't become a common phrase until the 90s, which goes to show that it was the 8-year-olds and 9-year-olds who were watching it in 1976 or whenever that came on, who decided to make jumping the shark a common usage.
Yeah,
and I can't think of who's jumped the shark.
Well, you get the Republican Party appear to be airborne over the shark just at the moment.
Even as we speak,
could argue.
Yes, I suppose so. Did Britain jump the shark when it voted 52-48 to leave the European Union?
Or did Britain jump the shark at Suez?
Oh, well, now it's becoming too serious.
Well, that's retrospective, I guess. I don't because that would have obviously predated the actual jumping of the shark, the Suez Crisis. It is an interesting illustration, though, of how language can mutate and how culture can develop. It is the Richard Dawkins-esque meme effect in excelsis, isn't it?
And never underestimate the cultural power of reruns.
and also the cultural power of something that was just terrible. I mean, this is the TV equivalent of that Noel Coward line about the potency of cheap music. You have this absolutely terrible scene in this fairly declining sitcom, and yet here we are decades later talking about it.
I know. And I suppose it's a tribute to Garry Marshall. He a guy from the Bronx who somehow was able to always just keep his finger there on the zeitgeist, at least of 11 and 12-year-olds, and say 14-year-olds who were skiving off from their homework and watching these extraordinary shows like Happy Days and Mork and Mindy and on and on and on, none of which really made me laugh too much. Well, Robin Williams used to make me laugh, but not as Mork.
Language is like magpies. It collects rubbish from all over the place.
That is all we have time for on today's Midori House, which was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Patrick Hunt, and Jacob Laderna. There's more music next at 1900. It's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, and there's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.